The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Ward was born in 1951 and received his Bachelor of Arts degree at Brigham Young University and his Master of Arts degree at the University of Utah. The Ender series all began in 1975 when Mr. Card wrote his short story version of Ender's Game. As has often been said about the novel Ender's Game, it is a science fiction novel for people who don't like science fiction. I know for a fact that this is true, for I myself am one of those people. Card's intriguing style of writing and his fascinating ideas drew me in to the point where I could not put the book down. As I have heard, this is not too uncommon. Therefore, it comes as no surprise that Mr. Card has received numerous awards for his Ender series, including the Hugo and Nebula Awards 2 years in a row for his novels Ender's Game and Speaker for the Dead, as well as the Locus Award for Speaker of the Dead.
Hello, I'm Lauren Rosenblum, also a student at Lower Merion High School. I recently read Ender's Game for a third time for the same assignment. I also read Mr. Card's latest book, Shadow Puppets. Along with his Ender series, Mr. Card has written both the Alvin Maker and Homecoming series. For the Alvin Maker series, he was awarded the Locus Award for the first, second, and fourth novels. He was also a finalist for the Hugo and Nebula Awards for novels in the same series. Aside from his three series, Mr. Card has received many awards for his independent novels. He won the Hugo Award in 1988 for his novella Eye for Eye, and again in 1991 for How to Write Science Fiction and Fantasy. In 1978, 79, and 80, he received Hugo Award nominations at the World Science Fiction Convention for his short stories, and another nomination in 1986 for his novelette Hat Track River, for which he also received the World Fantasy Award. As an avid reader of Mr. Card's, I know how much you are all waiting to meet him.
So, it is now our pleasure to introduce to you Mr. Orson Scott Card.
Hi, I appreciate you all coming, and I appreciate you being patient with the weird thing that I do beforehand, but I found that the signing line at the end is a lot better if we've gotten rid of the early people, because they're always the obnoxious ones. And so we get rid of as many of those as we can. Plus, the people who are sitting down front, I spit a lot when I'm talking, and they would need to get home early to dry off. So it's good for them to have theirs done, but every book will be signed that you want signed before I leave. What I'm going to do at the beginning, though, is answer questions, but I'm going to start by asking a question without waiting for anyone to ask it, because this is the one that slows down the signing line, because every fourth person asks, and that is, what about the Ender movie? So those of you who couldn't care less, sorry, but I'm going to answer this one in detail so there are no questions left on this subject. Ender's Game has been optioned by Paramount. That's the way it was looking a year and a half ago. By Warner Brothers. Man, I know I'm tired now. I slept way too well last night. By Warner Brothers, along with Ender's Shadow, to be made into the same movie to be called Ender's Game. By including Ender's Shadow with Ender's Game, it actually becomes writable now. Because believe me, I've tried. We've done a couple of earlier drafts, and while they would have made good movies, they just didn't have the emotional impact of Ender's Game. And we really were struggling to figure out why, but one of the reasons was simply that most of the emotional impact from Ender's Game comes from the fact that you're inside his head, and that is a place where movies cannot go. And that cripples us in writing a screenplay. We need to have something that externalizes the emotions. And the obvious thing is the relationship between Ender and his antagonist, but as long as the antagonist was Peter, it was still unfilmable because Peter is not there. Peter's somewhere else. And so, you know, what do? You have Ender walking along the street, walking along the battle room corridor, I mean, and you have a voiceover of Ender's voice thinking, I wonder what Peter's doing right now. And then you cut to Peter, and what is Peter doing? He's typing, because that's all Peter does. It just doesn't make for a good movie. Anybody who wants to watch teenagers type only has to go down in the basement where they keep the computer and watch their kids. So with Bean as a character of nearly equal importance in the movie, we can do what Hollywood does well, which is the buddy movie. And we can tell the same story, but we focus on their relationship because the adults set them up as rivals, And at first they really are rivals, and then gradually become very close friends. And by centering the movie on their friendship, we get back the emotional impact that had been lost with all the previous attempts at translating it. So it's going to work much better as a script. The real problem is just getting this sucker down to 2 hours. Because, you know, obviously if you filmed Ender's Game alone, scene by scene, that would be a five-hour movie, which, believe me, you may think you want to see it, but you don't. We're not talking just about bed sores that start forming. We're talking about the fact that scenes that play very well in a book don't play at all well on screen. Too many people think that when you're adapting, what you do is you take, oh, I love the scene by the lake. Well, if you took that scene, you know how long it is? In screen time, by halfway through the scene, you'd be going, shut up! Go back to space! You know, there's a patience threshold in film that just isn't there for books. With books, you expect it to take a little longer, plus you're reading at the speed of thought instead of at the speed of speech. Anyway, the folks at Warner that we're working with are very, very supportive of creative people. The only reason I said yes to them, because believe me, I've had plenty of offers over the years, was because they absolutely get it. They understand that Ender has to remain a kid. By the way, we're compressing the action of the film into 1 year so that we can cast one actor as Ender and not have to change. We tried once a version of the script, and it's not just Ender. I mean, you'd have to change six different kids and then try to get the audience to grasp who it was that the older one was supposed to be, and forget it. So it all takes place when Ender is about nine. The real problem we have with casting is we need to have two extraordinarily good child actors to play Ender and Bean. There have never been two extraordinary child actors in Hollywood at the same time. It has simply never happened. I mean, when you think of the great ones, Jackie Cooper, Margaret O'Brien, Roddy McDowall, Elijah Wood, Haley Joel Osment, who's the kid who played Elliot? Henry Thomas. You know, they've never been working at the same time. They've always been a few years apart. A film like The Good Son had to have two terrific child actors. Well, they got one, but then they had to use Macaulay Culkin for the other role. And, you know, nothing against Macaulay Culkin. I mean, it's great that he had the roles that he had, but he couldn't act. He could just look cute. And as long as all you have to do in a movie is go and then run around and do stuff, you know, then you're okay. But as soon as you have to be able to carry emotion in the way you read lines and the way you, you know, carry emotion in your face, then you've got to have somebody extraordinary. But whoever gets cast as Ender, it's not going to be anybody that you've seen on the screen before. Because whoever, you know, it'll be at least 2 years before we put it before the cameras. So whoever's going to play Ender and Bean is probably 6 or 7 years old right now. And they aren't acting in commercials, believe me, because commercials are all about the face, nothing about acting. So you won't have seen them, you won't know them. They'll be new, but they'll be brilliant, or we aren't going to be able to do the film. There's no point in putting $100 million into a film when you don't have the actors to carry the roles. I do still get impassioned letters from people saying, don't use that horrible Jake Lloyd as Ender. Now, we did talk to Jake a few years ago, back when he was young enough to play the part. Now he's too old. Jake would have been wonderful. Jake is a really talented, sharp, vigorous actor. He's really good. He was awful in Phantom Menace, but everybody in Phantom Menace was awful. And so it's hardly fair to blame poor Jake for what was clearly the problem with the script and the director. If Liam Neeson gives a lousy performance in the same movie, don't hold it against Jake Lloyd. I mean, Jake Lloyd didn't decide that Jake had to say, yippee. I mean, that was somebody else. And I challenge anyone here to say yippee convincingly. I don't think it can be done. There are just certain words that can no longer be said. More about the movie. Oh, the schedule. We won't know when it's going to be filmed until basically the script is right, the director's schedule is clear, the casting is set, and the money's in place. And so the studio has to sign off on it too. So, you know, who knows when that'll be. Could be 3 years, could be 4 years, could be 2 years. But I wouldn't look for it any time before the summer of 2005. Anything earlier than that would be radical. I mean, I would be shocked. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if it was 2006 or 2007. When people talk about movies being years in the making, That's why. I mean, this one's, it's been 15 years since it was first optioned long ago. That's the one where I learned all my lessons, because the first thing the guy wanted to do was make under 16 and give him a love interest, which, you know, was the would have been the death of the movie. I told him, if you want to remake Last Starfighter, buy the rights from them, you know, but it's not Ender's Game. And I think that's everything about the movie. Oh, Wolfgang Petersen is directing. And, you know, Wolfgang is a marvelous director, especially one who can deal with difficult ethical dilemmas. He makes films, action films, that are smarter and better and truer than they need to be. Because, believe me, action films don't have to be all that smart or true. But he makes them good. Plus, he's worked with children before. I think that his work with the children in the child actors in Neverending Story was very, very good. So this won't be new territory for him. So that's everything I know about the movie. And now, to forestall other repeat questions in the line, let me quickly run down all the series that I have that are open. There will be another Lovelock, another book about Lovelock. The second book in that series is called Rasputin. We're on chapter 7. This is a collaboration between me and Catherine Kidd, and we're alternating chapters. Chapter 7 is my chapter. We've been sitting here now for something like 5 years, but it's my fault because I don't know how to fix some problems that have come up, and probably we're going to have to go back and start over, and neither of us has the heart to do that, but we will. We'll do it, and we'll get it done. There will be one more shadow book called Shadow of the Giant after Shadow Puppets. I try to make each of these books be a complete novel in itself, but obviously at the end of Shadow Puppets there are some threads left dangling. Well before the end of Shadow of the Giant, Bean will be gone. I'm not pretending otherwise. You have been warned. You have been warned in 3 volumes already. So do not be surprised if he disappears from the series before it quite ends. But people have asked me, is there going to be a book about Petra? Yes, it's called Shadow of the Hegemon and Shadow Puppets and Shadow of the Giant. And I've had people say, well, are you going to do a book about how Peter becomes Hegemon? Yes, it's called Shadow of the Hegemon, Shadow Puppets, and Shadow of the Giant. Because obviously these books have now become as much about those other two as they are about Bean. And as Bean leaves, I mean, in the last book we're going to be bringing back in for more dominant roles. In Puppets, you get hot soup to a degree, you get a lot of a lie. We're going to see Dink Meeker again. We're going to see, you know, all the guys from the Geesh, basically. We're not going to see the dead guys. Sorry that I'm sniffling. I don't know what it is, but just signing books lately has just, as soon as I start signing them, maybe it's the dust from the books flips up in my nose, but I really don't have a cold. I'm not contagious, and I have already taken all the drugs I can take. So other series. Women of Genesis, there's one more, the obvious one, Rachel and Leah. And Alvin Maker, there are 2 more books, The Crystal City and Master Alvin. Crystal City is probably the next book I'm going to write. I didn't plan that. You're just about the first group to hear that, but the other day I was in New York, my publisher talked to me, and he brought it up, and he said, you know, this would be a really good time to get the next Alvin book, because the Shadow books have done so well, they've been on the New York Times list, that they can go in and perhaps get stronger placement in the bookstores for the Crystal City. Crystal City will be thicker than the other books because, well, I mean, let's face it, the first 5 books, that's what it took me to cover the outline for the first volume in the original proposal. I'm not going to spread the other books out. This is not a 15-volume series. So I'm going to have to cover a lot of territory in Crystal City, and it may be thicker than the others. Sorry if they don't line up nicely on the bookshelf. They'll try to get the heights the same. And they were getting a little bit worried if I delayed too long, Dennis Nolan might retire, the guy who does the cover art. But no, we'll have the same cover artist, even though now he's way more expensive than he was when we started. Do I have any other series? Oh, Pastwatch. There are 2 more Pastwatch books, one about Noah and his flood, which is referred to in the Columbus book. And then the 3rd one is about the Garden of Eden. And that one is probably going to offend just about everybody. So my wife has suggested that I save that one for last, and then I'll retire. Because, you know, sometimes you just have to know when to leave, right? And then, do I have any other series going? No, I think I've mentioned them all. I also do standalone books, like Enchantment and Homebody and Treasure Box and Lost Boys. And there'll be more along that line. I have one that I'm working out as a short story right now about a dragon that lives in a contemporary house. And it's kind of fun. I'm having a good time with it. So I may expand that into a novel. I certainly am working on, there's one that I'm working on with Queen Latifah. She's not committed to the final movie project, but the novel is going to be built so that the main character could be played by her. I think she's an extraordinary actress. She contacted me about something else. I played Bait and Switch on her. But this novel is one that's set in Baldwin Hills, which is an upper-middle-class black neighborhood in L.A., and magic breaks out in the world again. And magic, we find, is not nice. It's ugly. There's a reason why people used to sacrifice to keep it under control. And nobody will help them. Nobody takes them seriously. And so they have to deal with it themselves. Well, Queen Latifah's character, I asked her, I said, well, you know, you've played a lot of roles where you were the wise friend who sings. And what would you like to play in a movie? What is your dream character? She said, well, I want to ride a motorcycle and have people shooting at me. And since that's a good thing to have in a movie, and it works perfectly with my book, that's what we're aiming to have happen. Now, if somebody else plays the part, you'll already know that it was written for her, and there'll be no way that I can pretend that she wasn't first choice. It just means that we couldn't get our schedules together, because we know it couldn't be that she didn't like my book, right? And that, I think, covers every writing project under construction right now. There are some new books that, besides Shadow Puppets, there's a little anthology that we're selling on our website. It was really the program book for our convention in some ways. But it's very slim but expensive. It's a collector's item type thing, but very finely bound, and it should last several weeks longer than the paperbacks. But it contains three stories. One of them is the original Avengers game. Another one is Investment Counselor, which already appeared in the collection Far Horizons. And the third one appears there for the first time. It's called The Polish Boy, and it's the story of why Ender's father didn't go to battle school. And that one is going to be published in Poland and outside the country, but I'm expecting probably not to have a separate edition of it until it comes out as part of a bigger collection of mine. I will be doing a story collection. Maps in a Mirror, my old story collection, will be coming back into print in trade paperback this next summer. And we're going to try to get a new collection of the stories I've written since then out soon after that. And everybody's coming up with suggestions for titles. All of them stink. And so it may just be more stuff by Orson Scott Card or something like that. We'll see. In addition, those who care, my website, my author website is www. Why do we still have to say that? It's hatrack.com. And then there's a Mormon website, Nauvoo.com, and then there's the movie website, frescopics.com, but there's links in each one to all the others. And, you know, find one, you found them all. I also have a political one, which is really off the wall, called ornery.org, where I write a weekly column write two weekly columns for my local paper, for a local weekly called the Rhinoceros Times in Greensboro. And all the political stuff goes up as a column called War Watch every week. So anybody who is at all interested in that, check out the website, get offended, become irritated, whatever it is, but post something. And that's now everything that I get asked about in line. My email address is orsoncard@aol.com. Don't write if you have nothing to say. Don't write if you hate my books. I don't want to hear about it. I'm not going to revise them. They're already in print. That's just the way it is. So if there's something you don't like about it, read somebody else. That's all I can say. But if you have a question or something, by all means, ask me. If it's a question that a lot of people have asked and that I've answered a lot before, I'll forward it to my assistant, but she will never pretend to be me. If you get an answer from me, it's from me. If you get an answer from her, it'll say it's from her, and she'll say, here's what Scott usually says to that question. Okay, so now that's everything. Now, does anybody, are there any questions from, like, live people here? Yes. Okay, she's asking how I propose to handle the violence in Ender's Game in the movie. Well, there's actually a couple of problems. The violence is kind of a problem. One of the things is in the battle room, no gun. At least what we're thinking right now is that it's built into the flash suit, so they point their finger, and the flash suit has a thing. You'll see the laser lights and everything, but there will be no gun marketed. Okay, nothing that looks like a gun so anybody can get shot because they were playing astronauts and buggers, you know. The violence between kids, the Stilson scene is gone. But the shower scene is, you can't really film Ender's Game without that. You can film it discreetly so that you don't have to worry about the fact that they're naked, but the vulnerability is still needed, that there is no weapon at hand unless, you know, you can kill somebody with a bar of soap. And we'll be able to see Ender lathering himself up. But we are not going to do this lovingly done slow-mo. You know, that's not Wolfgang's style, and it's not mine. It's not going to be called for in the script, and I doubt that they'll film it that way, because the last thing we want on this is an R. Our natural audience includes a lot of teenagers and even preteens. We're not going to make a kids' movie out of it. It's going to definitely be a PG-13, because the subject matter is still very, very tough. But in terms of the physical violence, there will be some, but nothing worse than kids would probably see on the playground at some point during the year. The result, we're not even going to say in the movie that Bonzo dies. That's just never going to come up. We're just going to know that Ender wins. And that's all that really matters for the purposes of the film. Then we just move on. So I think we've covered that. Yes?
How are you going to deal with Ashiel?
Ashiel probably won't be in the movie. Painful as that is for me, Peter and Valentine will be very, very minimized. The only reason we would have Ashiel in the movie is if there's some idea that Warner wants to do a sequel based on my work, in which case there's no way to do it without Ashiel, because the obvious sequel is Shadow of the Hegemon. So if we decide that, then he will be in a token way, but he's not important to the story we're telling in the first movie. The books are still there. So, people will read the books and they'll find all of them and they'll go, cool, man, I wish he'd been in the movie. And then, that means that just 5 years later we can do it again as a six-part miniseries and then everybody will be in there. In fact, the reason I'm using the portable mic is so I can walk down here and actually see hands from farther back. So, yes. The funny thing is that it's personally they each want to have it be the opposite. But go ahead. What was your question?
Well, I was also wondering though,
if that's conscious. Yeah, it's somewhat conscious. I have to say that I don't write themes in my fiction. My books aren't about some topic. When I want to write about a topic, I write a column, I write an essay, and I label it as such. When I'm telling a story, I'm telling the story. But at the same time, looking back over my work, it's obvious to me that one of the things that interests me in my stories is the relationship between the individual and the community. And what I'm most attracted to are characters who build communities. So even though Ender is isolated, and the adults are deliberately isolating him in Ender's Game, his achievement is building that Jeesh, building that community of kids who would die for him. Even though he doesn't do any of the, there's no big Ender signs up on the wall, the whole Lenin and Stalin thing and Mao and so on. Or Saddam, who's using the same techniques now. But he finds a way to build a community. Bean, however, is truly antisocial. He does not want to belong to a community. He is on his own. And community is forced on him. Still dealing with a relationship, still dealing with construction of communities, but we have enough people coming in late that if there are empty seats in the middle, if you all kind of move in a little and free some seats on the aisle, let's take a second and do that. Because it's nicer than making them stand in the back. And these reserved seats, can we unreserve them? Unless you have a paper allergy, come on down and sit in these reserved seats. Okay, so now we can get people moving down, migrate, and I wasn't quite done answering that question. I think all my fiction is about community builders because I try to write fiction about grown-ups. And I know that sounds odd when you figure that my whole career seems to be books that start with children. But they only start with children because I basically structure my stories as biographies, and life starts as a child. And I emphasize that period of life precisely because biographies can't. There's always less data. When you're doing a real biography, there's less data about the childhood. But anybody who's raised a child knows most of the character traits, I dare say all the character traits that matter, show up before a child's five. And so if you look at a kid when they're very young, you're going to see the adult. Then what's interesting is seeing how that character grows into a role in a community. But the role that fascinates me, most literature is about adolescence, not necessarily about teenagers, but about people who are in the adolescent phase of life, which is the one where you cut yourself off from those who had authority over you, you reject your prior role, and you are in play, so to speak. You're the loner who has no settled role in society. That's what adolescents are, is people who've decided not to be children anymore and are not yet ready to take on the responsibilities of adulthood, so they are alone, trying on different hats, going like the Lone Ranger from town to town. At high school, of course, the equivalent is going from group to group, dressing like one group for a while, dressing like another for a while. I mean, that's the phase of life. Most literary novels are about people who are in the process of cutting themselves off, you know, having the affair, the divorce, quitting the job, you know, all the things that cause stress in life, and they're about the loners. I'm not interested in them. It's a fascinating phase of life, but there's no shortage of literature about it. What I'm interested in are the people who have taken the step beyond, the ones who want to settle down and commit to a relationship with individuals, with a community, build something that lasts. I write about grown-ups. That's what Ender is a kid who, well before his time, has the responsibilities of a grown-up thrust upon him, where he has to stay and finish. He wants to quit, but he stays and finishes. It's like Beowulf. The first half of Beowulf, he's a loner, wandering with his troop of soldiers, and comes and saves the village from Grendel and Grendel's mama, and then goes away. But the latter half, the second half of Beowulf, is about the grown-up. He's an old man. He's stayed in one place. He inherited his father's throne. He rules this place. He has responsibility. The dragon is coming, and he stands and dies in the effort to slay the dragon. That's the grown-up, the guy who stays, the woman who stays. And that's who I write about. And those are the people who build communities. That's what communities are made out of. Communities are not made out of the wandering loner hero. In fact, usually if communities are destroyed, they're destroyed by those people. You can tolerate a certain number of them. When you're led by them, you fall apart. But when you are led by grown-ups, you have something that lasts. So if you want to find an interpretation of my fiction, you know, that's as useful a one as any. But because I'm aware of it now, I sort of downplay it a little bit. Because as soon as I'm aware of a theme in my fiction, then I try to fight it, so that my fiction can be about stuff coming out of my unconscious and will therefore be truer. Because as soon as I'm planning stuff, then what? You decode my meaning, and I can say to you, did you get it? And you go, yeah, I got it. And, you know, that's a different game. It's a fun game. I have a master's degree in literature, and you know, I earned it. And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the process. But that's not what I think my writing is for. I'm trying to talk to civilians who don't have degrees in English and who don't think that the reason to read a book is to decode it. I want readers who think the reason to read the book is because you're going to care about these people and it's going to mean something to you. It's going to mean something emotionally. And yes, if you think about it afterward, I'd like to think that there are things that you can find intellectually. But I'd rather that you find stuff that surprises me when you tell me about it. And then I can go, oh, cool, is that in there? Because that's the best stuff, from my way of thinking. Long answer, but you had your hand up, yes. Did I ever consider writing The Hive Queen and The Hegemon or The Life of Human? Well, in a way, I'm writing The Hegemon with the Shadow series right now. The long version, not Ender's version. The Hive Queen, you already know all the stuff that would be in it. Life of Human, I gave you a chapter. I gave you the key information. But the important thing to remember is I told you that these books were so powerful that they changed the world. Therefore, I don't have the gall to write them. I wouldn't dare. Because, you know, the arrogance of writers say, well, I've told you that there is such a thing as a book that is so powerful it will change the world. Now I'm going to write it. You know, I'm just happy if I write a book that people will finish. And that's my goal. So, no, I'm not going to ever try to do those officially. I'm not going to do, in other words, the rules of Quidditch, you know, it's just not going to happen. Let me see if there's... Yes?
And what kind of books do you
What powers it? You know, I've never thought about it, but I'm assuming that as batteries shrink and as laptops last longer, we're going to have, you know, we're going to be able to take batteries the size of your thumbnail and power cities, you know. So, you know, things are getting more efficient all the time. So I assume that they plug them in at night. But, you know, I never thought about that while I was writing it. I never thought of it until this minute. But I can promise you that because you asked that in the movie, we'll watch them all plug their suits in at night. Yes. Oh, how I write. I write as little as possible because it's hard work and I'm a lazy person. I always feel like I've done enough for the day if I get up and go out and exercise. After that, I'm free to play video games, hang out with my kids, watch movies, watch television, eat, especially eat. And then I'm done, you know. But every now and then my wife points out that the bank accounts are running low, the checks will soon start bouncing, the rent is overdue, well, the mortgage nowadays, and then I have to finish something. And so then I'll write. But when I do write, I write quickly. I have to think about it for a long time before the fruit is ripe enough to pluck off the tree. But when I do the plucking, it's fast. Because I try to write in a very, I write an oral style. I write as if it were being spoken. It has to scan for reading aloud. So I'm not writing beautiful prose with just the right word. What I'm writing is stuff that flows. And a lot of that, I think, is my theatrical background. I learned to actor-proof my lines when I was writing plays. And the way you do that is by making sure that there is no way to read it wrong. Now, I never achieved that, but you keep trying for it. And when you do that, you end up with prose that you sort of slide through without noticing. It's what Asimov was so good at. He's one of the great teachers of prose writing, is that Asimov wrote invisible style. You don't ever notice the writer. You only notice the story. That's perfect writing, folks. Because as far as I'm concerned, any time the style is so beautiful that you go, oh, that passage was so lovely, the story stopped right there, just stopped. It's over for that moment. And then you have to gear back up and get back into it. It's like doing a play where every few minutes the author jumps up on the stage and says, did you like those lines? I wrote those lines. And you'd get real tired of the author, and I do. I get really tired of authors who do intrusive stuff. So I write this oral style. Well, the only way that I can really achieve that is to virtually speak my fiction. And so I don't. I don't dictate it, because then it would be, you know, there's not enough money in the world to pay the typist to do that. I type, but I type about 100 to 120 words per minute. And so it comes out almost like the speed of thought, almost like the speed of speech. I mean, and so because I work that way, it takes me usually about 6 weeks to write a book. And not all of that is writing. Usually I take the first week, I write and work my way. And you'll notice a lot of my books have a very similar structure. Three or four, maybe five really short chapters at the beginning, and then suddenly long chapters through the rest of the book. That first week, it's those short chapters. Tough sledding, getting to know people, characters start coming up, I start getting the feel of voice and everything. And then I have to sit on it for a couple of weeks to let the new characters that have come in, the people, the things that aren't in my outline, gel. And then when I can come back to it, it's usually 3 to 4 weeks to finish the book. So it's, you know, when I say 6 weeks, that's usually once I write word one in chapter one, 6 weeks later, the thing's done. Every now and then, there, you know, Saints is a really long book. It's about 200,000 words, and that took 10 weeks. But once it's moving, the chapters, you know, I do a chapter a day, and that can be 10 or 15,000 words. So it goes fast when I'm in it. So do I write every day? No, I couldn't maintain that pace. I'd die. Of course, I'm going to die anyway, but, you know, I'd rather have more books done before I do it. When I write 2 books a year, that means I worked 12 weeks in the year. Now, I'm thinking about stuff, reading stuff all the time and preparing, and I write shorter things, and I have my weekly columns. And I say columns. I didn't mention that the other one I do is Uncle Orson Reviews Everything, and it shows up on Hat Rack every week, and I mean everything. Every kind of thing. So I review, like, soap. And I will undoubtedly talk about Blue, the restaurant I ate at last night, which had a great beet salad. I'm just so into beet salads right now. So I get to talk about whatever I want. And if you don't find it entertaining, then read something else. But, that's, so I do those things where I write on them every week. But other than that, no schedule. In fact, you asked about schedule. I'm going to go even further. I am one of those depressive personalities who, I can't even call it a sleep disorder, but as soon as I find myself on a normal schedule where I'm waking up at 7, taking my daughter to school, I go to bed at 10:30 at the same time as my wife, and, you know, sleep the normal, then I will pull an all-nighter. Not deliberately, I just can't get to sleep. And I lie there reading in bed until about 7 in the morning, fall asleep, and then suddenly I'm off the clock from everybody else. And I'll do that one for a few days, then I get into a different one. I'll have the night where I sleep 2 hours, the night where I sleep 11. It's just a nightmare, really. Because it's not healthy, and I don't enjoy it, but when you can't sleep, you can't sleep. And I've tried, believe me, I've tried Tylenol PM, and it works, especially if you're doing a long... If you're flying to Australia or Indonesia, take it on the plane because you need it for jet lag. Otherwise, the drugs just make it so the next day is wasted because those things have too much of an effect on me. So, you know, it's more than you wanted to know. But that's one of the nice things about asking me questions is we don't have to come up with a lot of questions to keep me talking, do we? Yes.
Since you write so much in series, I'm curious to know if you've ever gotten book 3 or 4 in a series and say, this is find yourself trapped by something that you wrote in the first volume.
That has only ever happened in the Ender series. Because none of the Ender books were ever meant to be part of a series, ever. All the other series were planned from the beginning. They were outlined. As I made changes, I was aware of how it would affect the end because I knew the end from the beginning. Because the other series aren't really series. I take that back. Something like Sarah and Rebecca and Rachel and Leah, that is a series, but they completely stand alone. Whatever I do in the first book isn't going to have much effect on the second book because there's just no overlap. Some characters overlap, but there's no overlap in events. There's no threads left dangling at the end of Sarah that will be resolved in Rebecca. With something like Homecoming or the Alvin Maker series, I knew the end right from the start. It was meant to be a single closed series. It's really, to me, one story, which is just taking me way too long to write. Homecoming's done, though. I finished that. That one's closed. Proving that I could close a series, something my publisher had serious doubts about. But with the Ender series... Ender's Game was a short story. Then I started working on this idea of the Speaker for the Dead, and all of a sudden I thought, what if the Speaker were Ender, years and years later? Then I only wrote Ender's Game in order to set up, wrote the novel in order to set up Speaker for the Dead. But I had no plans for anything after that. Speaker for the Dead was closed. So halfway through writing Speaker for the Dead, my agent calls me and said, hey, I sold the Ender trilogy in England. And I said, well, that's great, but when it's a trilogy, don't they usually want 3 books? And she says, can't you think of another? And the fact is there was another book completely unrelated that was called Philotes that I had toyed with. It had been rejected by Jim Frankel. He had said, you know, this is a terrific idea, but you're not ready to write it yet. And he was right. I recognized immediately that I just didn't have the skills yet because it was a very complicated metaphysical thing that was really, it would be hard to read at the best of times because there's so much to explain that's really weird. But I wanted to write it. And I suddenly thought, you know, what if Ender were the captain of the ship that went outside and started creating things with their minds? Whoa, that would be cool. So I said, okay, you can sell the trilogy. And again, Xenocide and Children of the Mind were supposed to be one book. I have sort of that Robert Jordan disease where they spread a little bit. And so each of those books had its own origin. And yeah, there was stuff. Fortunately, I knew that there was going to be Xenocide and Children of the Mind halfway through Speaker, so I could leave some things open to prepare for it. But I had no plans for doing the Shadow books, none. And you have no idea how painful. It was like doing a novelization, which I did once with The Abyss. And even though it was a great script, it's just hard to take another writer's words when the characters had become mine and make the characters say what another writer chose for them to say. Well, the same thing happens when I was the other writer. By the time I got to the scenes that I had to use from Ender's Game, word for word in Ender's Shadow, Bean, I just knew so much more about Bean that he would never say those things. And I had to make him say them and find reasons why he would say them. And I hated it. It was hard. Meanwhile, though, the nice thing is there are a lot of members of the Hat Rack community who are willing to read my manuscripts in advance and catch the contradictions, because there's no way I can remember all the stuff I wrote. I mean, I wrote Ender's Game 15 years ago, please, you know, and I don't reread my books every year. I'm writing new ones, and I'm thinking about the new ones. And so there's stuff I just forget, you know. So I rely on my dedicated readers who have read it 18 times or last week to say, but you can't have him do that because you said this. Then I can fix it before it gets published. We never catch them all. There's always some little flaws. And can't help that. There are flaws within each book, too. We catch the big ones, we hope. And then we fix things in the movie, like adding the plugged-in rechargeable batteries in those flashes. But anybody else bothered by the lack of explanation about how the suits were plugged in? No? Well, you will get to your question in a second, because I actually want your email address, because your questions have become very important. Well, I'll ask it now. What is it? What is your question?
What powers their spaceships?
Okay, now the spaceships. I will tell you right now that I have no intention whatsoever of answering that question ever, because I find that, I mean, there are lots and lots of science fiction writers in the past who've come up with all kinds of mechanisms for running spaceships, so many that, as far as I'm concerned, you can mentally go to your own menu of all the solutions you've already seen to those problems and pick one, because I don't care. And I'm not going to spend any time. I use faster-than-light flight because that's what I needed in, I mean, speed of light limited flight because that's what I needed in Ender's Game. I needed to have the same situation as, for example, when you had fast ocean transit across the Atlantic and the cable to send telegrams. You can get there fairly fast, but it was still a week, and you don't do it trivially. You don't do it lightly. But the cables could go instantly, and that's what I needed in Ender's Game and Speaker for the Dead. I needed to be able to have it be very slow getting from planet to planet. I mean, not slow, but taking a long time. But subjectively, about a week. But I wanted messages to go at once. So I used Ursula Le Guin's Ansible, and because it became important to the story, I had to figure out how the Ansible worked. I had no intention of doing that until I was writing Xenocide and Children of the Mind, where it matters. And then you'll notice that's where I explain how it works. And otherwise, I black box my stuff. If I have a machine, I'll tell you what it does. I'll tell you what you have to do with it to make it do that, if you need to know. And other than that, I just don't care. I don't write science fiction about science. There are people who know science way better than I do. And so the answer to your question is, you grow up and decide how it works. You'll tell us. Fair enough? Okay, let me take somebody from farther in the back, because people in the back always feel so persecuted, but really it's your fault for choosing that seat. Yes. Yeah, constantly. I can hardly write in silence. I actually also watch movies while I write, which sounds insane. But the American movie classics and Turner Classic Movies play lots of wonderful old movies, some of them good, most of them bad, and I'll have them droning on while I'm writing. I've never yet put a line of dialogue from the movie into my books, but I do that a lot, but most of the time it's music. And I'm very eclectic. I used to have this jukebox, CD jukebox, with 200 CDs in it. Now I use a Rio Riot MP3 player, and I rip all my CDs, the ones that I want, you know, or selected bits from the ones that only have two good songs on them. And then I choose random play. Anything can come up. I can have the movement. I wish that there was some way with these MP3 players to bond certain tracks together, so that they always play together. I want a complete symphony. It's the one thing that irritates me. What? Well, you're talking Mac. Forget it. You know, it's, I'm sorry. I've got to admit that it's the martyr complex, but I prefer to suffer the slings and arrows of Windows. But anyway, I actually hate Windows and hate Microsoft, but, you know, Apple is just as evil in their own way. Where was I going with this? We were talking about the music, but I have lots and lots of country singers that I love, lots of classical music, lots of Brazilian music, very little rap, partly because this energetic driving prose would wreck my rhythm. I do have to be able to maintain my own rhythm when I'm writing. Lots and lots of great pop tunes from the 30s, 20s, 30s, 40s, and the writers who write like that and the singers who sing like that still. So I've got a lot of Rosemary Clooney and some contemporary jazz singers that I really love, Diana Krall, people like that. And then old folk tunes. You know, I was a Joni Mitchell fan. Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. Now you know how old I am. What?
You already said how old you are.
Oh, that's right. That's right. But now you have the practical hands-on application. And there are only a few kinds of music that I really loathe. Cannot stand disco. Just couldn't stand it then, can't stand it now. There were a couple of good songs, Changes by David Bowie and a couple of the early BG ones before they went completely plastic, but not many from that era. So, you know, I am very highly opinionated. I don't like Tchaikovsky, love Stravinsky, love Bach, bored by several of the other greats. You hear one Chopin etude, after a while it starts to feel like you've heard them all. It's not true. I have the complete etudes, but I can't tell them apart, can you? That's more than you wanted to know about my music, but nobody's ever asked that one before, so you got it. Yes. Well, I do take. He asked, "Do I take notes or do I write off the top of my head?" I do write down notes. I just never look at them again. With the exception of, like, when I was doing the homecoming series, I deliberately came up with a calendar and weeks and stuff like that, and I tracked the time because that was very important in that story. With the Ender series, you'll notice you can't follow the calendar. I don't give you dates. I don't give you years. I did in the first book, but I dropped it because I was finding that I was losing track of it, so who cares? I'll just tell you what happens in the story. You work out the times later. But only a few times do I actually... And when I do a map, I refer to the map constantly. But I write all kinds of notes. That's how I develop the ideas till the story becomes ripe. But when I'm actually writing, I don't need the notes because I'm following what comes up as I'm going, and the stuff that matters is already in my head. So, yes and no. Yes?
How conscious are you of kidney function, which even fictional characters have?
Yeah, it's one of the things that really irritates me about a lot of fiction and movies is that nobody ever pees. Haven't you watched movies where you think you're following the guy all day? And, man, this guy has a cast iron bladder. And then at the end of all of that, there's a chase and he can run. Now, I do run. It's sad because, of course, I'm carrying 260 pounds with me, so I'm not at all offended when you're running for your life. You just have to let it go. And I want to see the end of the chase scene where the hero has just peed his pants because there was no way to run on a full bladder. I actually, every now and then, you know, readers don't actually want to spend a lot of time. I mean, does it really matter with a character to know how he aims his little pointer, where he chooses to squat? I don't think we want to see it, but we want to know that the author is taking account of the real world. And I who? Well, I haven't read that much of her, but she'll handle it her way. I handle it mine. I try to deal with it realistically. Yes. Well, you're going to get to ask one of them. Then I'm going to throw something at you. So go ahead. But it was really the culture of battle school, mostly. And then, yeah, you're talking about... are you asking why I do that?
Yeah.
It's deliberate. It's a plan. I may not have themes in my fiction, but I do have things that I want my fiction to accomplish. One of them is, for a long time, science fiction was plagued with sort of a consensus reality, consensus future that consists... It can be summed up this way. Americans in space. Science fiction from the 30s, 40s, 50s, even the 60s, even the 70s, was mostly written by Americans and reflected American culture and just sort of assumed that the future would be American. And mostly that was because the writers didn't really know any other cultures and it didn't occur to them that human beings could be any different ways. Now, I did live in Brazil for a couple of years, but also just growing up Mormon in America makes you bicultural because Mormon culture is way different from American culture, but we pass. We learn very early that somebody that you call Brother Smith at church becomes Mr. Smith in the grocery store. Now we're a little bit less paranoid about it, especially in the South. You can get away with calling people brother this and brother that. But that's just trivial, but there is a lot of cultural difference. And so I've always looked at America as an outsider. Of course, you know, also look at everything as an outsider and an insider because that's what writers have to do. But then when I was in Brazil, that was a real education. Because I immerse myself enough in Brazilian culture and language to then see America through new eyes. Well, if science fiction has any job, it should be that. You know, since we set every story in a world different from the present reality, our readers should come away from it having that sense of having been in a different place so they can see their own culture through different eyes. And I, even though that can make it a challenge to read, you know, I think the world of Path and Xenocide is fun, but at the same time difficult. And the Portuguese in Speaker for the Dead, I do my best to make sure that you always know what was said, but that you do get the sense this is a place where they talk a language you don't speak, and they think of things in ways that you as an American probably wouldn't think of them. And that's an ongoing program. I intend to keep it up, too. Even with the Alvin Maker series, what I'm doing is trying to show you an America that was, the America that people of that time thought they lived in, where the magic worked and all of that stuff. But it's still not present-day America. And so, you know, who knows how successful I am at it, but I don't know, maybe some of you have had that that effect of coming back and feeling like like you saw the rest of the world through different eyes. I would hope so. In the meantime, also, it's good for Americans to keep in mind that the future will contain people who are not Americans. In fact, we'll be darn lucky if it contains people who are Americans. Yes?
Who's your favorite science fiction author besides
yourself? He asked who my favorite science fiction author is besides myself. My favorite is not myself. So, you know, I love the stories that I write. That's why I write them. But I have no idea whether they're any good or not. So I can't, you know, I don't read mine. I read other people. But considering living and dead, I'd have to say that Asimov and Bradbury were the two who were most important to me. I don't want to say influenced me, but they set a bar. Bradbury's music was so incantatory, the music of his prose. His poetry, actually, I find leaden, but his prose is poetic. It feels like verse. And it sort of gave me permission as a writer to do the oral thing that I do. In fact, I really do use, I got this also from Shakespeare, because it's a technique that Shakespeare uses at the end of scenes. Of course, all of his scenes, most of them are in blank verse. But at the end of a scene, for closure, there'll be a rhymed couplet, sometimes four lines that rhyme in pairs. And that just puts a period on the end. It just closes the scene so wonderfully that I sometimes do, I don't rhyme, but I'll take, you know, it's been in prose, it's been, but all of a sudden in the last paragraph or so, I will write it in blank verse. Then I run it all together so you can't tell. But it scans as poetry, and it has the same effect. When you start finding those rhythms, because, you know, we all read orally, you know, even if we're not moving our lips, it still processes, scientists have found that it actually processes through the speech center of the brain. Because if you're reading along and you find an unpronounceable word, you stop as surely as if you were reading it aloud. Because you are pronouncing everything mentally. And so when you come into a place where the rhythms work that way, then you get that same closure. Well, I didn't get that specific technique from Bradbury, but I sort of got the permission to write a fluid musical style. At the same time, from Asimov, I got the goal of writing with absolute clarity. So my goal, I don't think I ever achieve it, but my goal is to write as flowingly as Bradbury and as invisibly as Asimov. They are mutually exclusive goals, you understand. I do recognize that. But I still try for both. And I'd have to say they're for me, the great ones. There are others that I absolutely love. Le Guin and Heinlein, very important to the field. And there are contemporary writers who are... Octavia Butler is marvelous. Brilliant. If you have not been reading Octavia Butler, repent at once. She's brilliant. In fact, I would have to say, of the living, practicing science fiction writers right now, she just has no equal. She's the best. Is that a good enough question? Outside of the field, Richard Russo, Ann Tyler. Ann Tyler does the family thing that I try to do. Everybody's networked into families, and so she's terrific. I think we're probably at the end of the time. I hear people rattling their books as if the bell had just rung. that it's always a sign that it's about over, but yes. The Alvin Maker series, the particular inspiration actually for the Alvin Maker series was that I was a grad student in English at the University of Utah, and I was studying Fairy Queen, and I thought, you know, no one's ever done a vernacular American epic. And so I thought, you know, what would you write it in? What language would you write it in? It's too late to write it in the way that Americans talked when we were starting out, but wouldn't it be kind of cool to do that? You know, what Tolkien did for England with Middle Earth, I thought it would be fun to do for America. Go back into our past use our folklore, our traditions, and come up with something that really worked. I originally wrote Prentice Alvin and the No Good Plow as an epic poem. It doesn't go all the way through the story, but let's put it this way, it goes farther than the books do, because there are scenes at the end of that poem that I haven't got to yet. But it was the start. Of course, there's no market for it, and so I decided to write it in prose so that it would actually reach an audience. But the poem is still, you know, didn't I include it in Maps in the Mirror? I think I did. So it's been out there for people to read, and you know, for all I know, it sucks pond scum, but it was fun to do, and I fell in love with the story. So that was the reason I wrote it. Now, to give myself a plot line, I used the life of Joseph Smith, the founder of the Mormon Church, but it is not about Joseph Smith by any means. All that happens is that there are a couple little incidents where Mormon readers would go, oh, cool, he's using that. That's all it is. I'm writing about America. I'm not writing about Mormonism. If I want to write about Mormonism, I'll do it a different way. You know, if I write about Mormon culture, you'll see it openly, as in Folk of the Fringe or Saints. If I want to write about Mormon doctrine, I write essays. So, you know, it's don't fear that I'm secretly proselytizing and sneaking these things. In a sense, though, of course, do fear it, because unconsciously, what I really believe is going to show up in all my work. And so it's going to include all the stuff that about, you know, all of my beliefs that irritate Mormons and all my beliefs that are absolutely orthodox Mormon. Those are going to show up, but not consciously. I have no plan for that. Yes? Oh, what a nightmare. I have no idea, and I never want to know. I would hope that it would be sweet, beautiful, lovely things, but I fear that it would look like the adolescent fantasies of a randy 15-year-old, for all I know. So, you know, it's one of those things where if I do go, I'm going alone, because I don't want anybody else to see what my mind creates. You had your hand up a minute ago?
Yeah, you said you played video games. I'm just curious.
Well, I used to go into the 7-Elevens and stuff and play the video games until I started getting old enough, my reflexes were slow enough, that I was no longer getting on the vanity boards. Back when they start, you know, when these games started, you know, Pong leading to Breakout, I was great. I was number one on every machine I touched. But I got older. I slowed down. Plus, they all got into these kickboxing violence fantasies that I couldn't care less about, and all the games that were clever and interesting and fun to me moved on to the computers. Now I play the little nuisance games, you know. Tetris not so much, because it does things you start hallucinating those shapes coming out. Seriously. I have taught whole Sunday school lessons where the entire time I was turning shapes in my mind. It's very distracting. But because it tells you what I was doing right up to the minute I left for church. But and, you know, things like Free Cell and stuff on the computer just to warm up and avoid work. And then when I really want to avoid work, I continue to play Civilization 2. I can't play Civilization 3 because Civilization 2 allowed you to break into the program and change all the parameters to make it the game I want to play. And you can't do that with Civ 3, and so it's boring to me because it becomes a game about not getting killed by the other civilizations. I want the game, and does this sound like me? I want the game where I get to spend most of my time discovering, building, creating the civilization, making it all work together and moving forward as quickly as possible. So I always play to the year 210 AD to compete against myself to see how far I can move the civilization, how many people there are, how many achievements I can make. By the time I get to 210 AD, then I stop. Because if I played them all to the end, that's all I would do with my life. I can play one game of Civ 2 up to 210 AD in one day. And many a day, that's all I've done. Yes? The future of mankind, I'm very optimistic. I think that humanity will survive in spite of the efforts of the environmentalists. Because I don't think of humanity as a disease infecting the earth. I do think of us as the culmination of life on earth. But we have grave responsibilities. So please don't think I'm anti-environmentalist either. I just am in favor of sane environmentalists, who are quite rare right now. But future of humanity, in the long, long run, will survive. In the short run, things like, do I think Western civilization will survive? Well, it seems not to want to right now. The whole multicultural movement is essentially a collective death wish to say, we're worthless, we're nothing, everybody's better, we have no rights, we should not impose our culture on anyone. I'm thinking, wait a minute, you know, we've achieved some things, more than just fridges, but fridges are not nothing. you know, even if it's just flush toilets and refrigeration, that's good. But it's things like human freedom and and democracy and stuff like that that I'd really like to see survive. I would like to see it survive. Do I think it will? Man, I don't know. We'll see. We'll see how this thing runs out right now, because this is the struggle we're in right now is, you know, I'm not sure I want to live in a world ruled by Osama bin Laden. And people think, well, he could never take over the world. Don't kid yourself. Don't kid yourself. There's a lot of Muslims. If he ever united the Muslim people behind him and became Mahdi, and it became a credible threat, and the West continued to have its death wish, because empires that have decided to fall. They don't need that many barbarians to fall. Remember that when Rome fell, there was never a point where its enemies outnumbered it, or were technically better, or had more resources. Never. In fact, their enemies were usually people that they had invited in and trained themselves. Yeah. Whatever that is. Yes.
Well, you mentioned multiculturalism, and yet this whole country was founded on multiculturalism.
It was founded on multiculturalism that then immediately synthesized. The goal was synthesized. That is, yes. I mean, for example, there were centers of German culture right up to World War I. And when they all had to, you know, all the German language newspapers had to stop publication to survive, and so on. So that we remain with these undigested lumps for a while. But now, you know, 100 years ago, it was still really important, the difference between being of an Italian and an Irish family. The Irishmen came earlier and were entrenched, and the Italians came later and were not. Even though they were both Catholic, that didn't mean they got along. And the Russian Jews who came after them. I mean, all these were, the differences were really, really important. Are they so important now? But there are some differences we've artificially kept important. The differences between blacks and whites, artificially kept important. There are people who are struggling to try to keep the distinction between Latino and American a real distinction, though there are places where we're simply redefining what it means. See, that's the nice thing, is that we have to redefine what it means to be American. That's how we make it, make us one nation. But multiculturalism is a rejection of the very thing that unifies America, which is Western culture. The thing is, look around you. Everybody here has ancestors who came from different places, okay? But yet, we can all legitimately, if we're Americans, we can say our forefathers, our foremothers, if you want to be radical, but our the founders of our country, that's our history. Even if not one of your ancestors got off the boat until after 1783, nevertheless, it's our revolution. We are this people. And what we do as a country is we bring people in and we let them adopt this country and we adopt them as fellow citizens. And there are growing pains and elbows in the jaw like a rough basketball game for a while, but ultimately, we end up on the same team. That's what America does, because it's an ideologically based nation, not an ethnically based nation. And those who would like to make ethnicity more important than the ideology that binds us together are making a huge mistake, because we can't endure as a nation where ethnicity is more important than the ideology. And when you downplay the ideology, downgrade it, say that it is worthless or not as good as other cultures, and at the same time play up the ethnicity, what you're really saying is, let's stop existing. Because there is no America if we are divided into these groups, and that division commands more allegiance than our allegiance to the whole. Does that make sense? I can talk about it for... America is just one iteration of community theory, okay? And there are other communities that work very well. So I'm not saying that America is the be-all and end-all of creation, and it can certainly be better than it is. But there are rules that nations follow, whether they want to or not. And America's breaking some really big ones for nations that might wish to survive. We're not behaving in the way that nations behave when they wish to last. And not completely, you know, and we're not gone yet. But I don't think people realize how fragile we are. It's like in Yugoslavia, nobody dreamed of what would happen when Tito died and communism fell. Nobody dreamed how vicious and awful and vile it would become, and how the ethnic hatreds would spring up and the ancient ethnic rivalries. So I'm always terrified when I hear black leaders, for example, and fortunately only very marginal white guys do this, but some very mainstream black leaders essentially call for the continuation of hatred. And are there reasons for it? Absolutely. Every bit as good as the reasons that Croatians have for hating Serbians and vice versa. Very good reasons. If you're going by reasons alone, it would be perfectly justified for black people to just grab guns and kill white people wherever they find them. That's as rational as you can get. But what future is there in that? None, for them or us. Because, of course, if they ever started doing that, they would lose. I mean, it would destroy them, because there are a lot more white people. You know, if we ever had race war in this country, it would be terrible. But there are people who try to maintain the climate of hatred that creates race wars whenever authority breaks down. And if we ever came to a place where we had an authority breakdown, I greatly fear that the seeds have already been sown for massacres and slaughters, because it doesn't take very long for fear to turn into killing in the human race. And we don't have to search very far to find examples in our own past either. And so while the history of treatment of blacks in this country is despicable, if anybody ever tries to even the score, that will be the end of our country. You know, so sometimes you just have to swallow hard and forgive and just say, let's move on, and we're all brothers now, right? Except for those of us who are sisters. I don't know. Why am I slipping back? I used to be so politically correct in my speech, and now I'm slipping back to the all-masculine thing. Is it because I'm getting old and reverting to my childhood patterns? I suppose that's what it is. Yes. My treatment of human emotion, I'm going to sidestep your question very briefly and say, I try not to treat human emotion in my fiction. I mean, yes, they will feel something, but I don't write about the feelings of the characters because, it's something I learned on stage. If you put somebody on stage and make them cry, it doesn't make the audience cry, it makes the audience stop needing to cry because it releases it. If you want the audience to feel something, you put your characters through something that makes it so that those emotions would be the natural response, and then you don't have them show it. Then the audience will do it for you. So on stage, if I want somebody to cry, if I want the audience to cry, then I'll make a person get really emotional, but he will not cry. Okay? That's how you make an audience cry. You don't have somebody start blubbering and the tears coming down their face. Nobody cries at that, you know. It's just like if a comedian's laughing at his own jokes. You don't have to laugh, do you? But if he tells it with a straight face, and then it's funny, you'll laugh for him. You know, same technique. So how do I handle emotions? As little as possible. And, I'm not in charge of this. When am I supposed to end this? I mean, how long do we want this to go? Okay, that's good. We'll take 5 more minutes, so we'll end about 3:15. I'll stop at about 3:12 or so, and then I will start giving you my spiel about how we handle signings so that it goes smoothly. But yes. In Shadow Puppets at the Beginning, one of my characters espouses the meaning of life. I have no memory of writing this. So who says it? Who is the character? Okay, Anton says, listen to me, both of you. Here is the meaning of life. For a man to find a woman, for a woman to find a man, the creature most unlike you, and then to make babies with her, with him. It's really, I'm not saying that's the meaning of life. Because that's from, I think that what he's saying is truthful, but it is certainly not the whole meaning of life. I have, if you want my idea of the meaning of life, it's way bigger than that. But as a rule of thumb, that will do. Because human life takes place in communities, and any community who remembers that the center activity is getting heterosexuals together to mate. If you don't have the mating and the babies, and you don't find ways to raise the babies well, your civilization, your culture, your community is gone. Obviously, it is so obvious it hurts. And if you ever move that function from the center of your society and make it more difficult for people to meet, mate, and have babies and raise them well, you're dead. You're gone. People will migrate to a place where they can, or they'll have a revolution and change things until they can. Because if that isn't succeeding, nothing else works. And so it's in the best interest of everybody, even those who are not interested in taking part in that activity, to nevertheless support it with everything they have. Because as long as that's working, everything else can work too. So, yes, that I did mean that, but it is so far from being complete that, I mean, that's really, we're almost at the biological level here. One step above, raw community formation. Baboons know this. Only humans forget it. Okay, yes. The real excitement with Ender's Game was getting that check. Because my reason for starting to write fiction was that as a playwright I had lost so much money. I'd started a theater company and it didn't lose that much. We did pretty well. But on my salary of $7,000 a year, a debt of $2,000 or $3,000 was enormous. And I had no way of paying it off. And so I started writing fiction in hopes that I would sell the stories. And when Ender's Game sold, it was $300. And that was so important to me at that time. And so I just, that check, I just thought, yes, I'll write another. And so, you know, I know that sounds like a horrible motive, but I'm not ashamed of the fact that you know, like everybody else, I needed money. And this is the only thing I could ever find that anybody would pay me to do. You know, I thought of a career as a gigolo, but since girls wouldn't go out with me anyway, I figured that was really not available to me. What they won't take for free, they're not going to pay for. But yes. The story Remind Me Again. It's a little film that I have that's on my website. It's 10 minutes long. Four of my friends filmed mostly inside my friend's living room. And our lighting system was a lamp from Target that had three. It was a pole lamp with three lamps that we put bulbs so hot that they melted the plastic around them. I mean, we had plastic dripping down, you know, but we filmed this. It's online for free, and I think it's really funny. What is my reason for that? If I could write what I really want to write, I would be writing musical comedies and romantic comedies, contemporary romantic comedies. No one will buy those from me because I'm so tied to the genre that a place like Knopf would be ashamed to publish a mainstream fiction by me. It would mean that they had sold out to a commercial writer. It's fine, I'm reaching my audience with the stories that I do, but in order to write one of the things I want to write, which is contemporary fiction, contemporary romantic comedy, like Enchantment, I have to have a fantasy element in it, which is fine. Remind Me Again even has the fantasy element in it. There's just a touch of magic at the end. It's the basic premise of the comedy is there's a guy who forgets everything immediately. He has chronic memory failure, chronic amnesia. And I exploit the comic potential. I think it's really funny. If you don't, then we disagree. But it's there. It's free. If you have a real media player on your computer, you can watch it. Yes, blonde hair right back there. Yes. I'm glad that you like Unaccompanied Sonata. I suspect it may be the best story I ever write in my life. But there's no way I can ever do it again. It just was one. It was one of only two stories that just came. Yes, I played French horn and sousaphone in high school. Got into the state band on sousaphone in Arizona. But when I moved to Utah, the school I went to didn't have, they already had 9 French horns. They didn't need me. They didn't have a marching band, so what's the point of tuba? And so I just dropped it. I still play guitar and piano. I play piano badly. I just mainly fake it. But I can sit down at the piano and entertain myself for an hour just making stuff up. And that's as good as I need to be, because I'm not going to perform it for anybody ever. But music's really important to me. Mostly, though, what I do is sing. I won't, you know, bore you with it now, but I'm a reasonably good church tenor. You know, every choir that I ever join is happy to have me so far. If they're ever unhappy, then I'll know it's over. And every now and then I'll be in a musical. I got to play the priest in Man of La Mancha in a community theater about two years ago. Time flies when you're 51. So I got to sing To Each His Dulcinea, which is one of the great songs of musical comedy literature. And so I get to indulge myself now and then, but I have no plans for a recording career. What time are we at? Okay, no, we really are at the time when I can't take any more questions, but let me say, we're going to do the signing. Stay in your seats for just a minute, because I'm going to tell you stuff that if we all follow this, it will not be as painfully long as it looks like it might be, because there's a lot of you. First of all, the thing, you know, I will sign every book you want signed, okay, so don't worry about that. I'm not going to put some limits that you can't sign it. But signature only is really fast. I write my signature faster than you can say my name, okay? But a lot of you, most of you probably, want books personalized. You want it to be to you, to prove we met, right? And I'm happy to do that. But if you brought 19 of my books, do we have to personalize them all? That's really the question. If I personalize one or two and then just sign the rest, it'll speed everything up for everybody. And you'll have those personalized books, and you'll have the ones that look like serious collector books, because serious collectors, of course, never personalize, because they're going to resell them. So they don't want them personalized. I'm not saying, you know, if you have books for 8 different people and you want them all personalized, of course I'll do that. There's a purpose for it. But if they're all for you, pick a couple that really would mean more to you to be personalized. 3 if you have to. And I won't complain. I'll be happy to do it. I'll start complaining if you want. In fact, I won't personalize 13 or 14 just because there are other people in line. If you really want 13 or 14 personalized, then you'll have to wait till the end of the line. I'll sign the first 5 maybe that way and then go on back through for the rest. But this way things will move a lot faster, I promise you. But if you have 15 of my books, 20 of my books, 25 of my books, and all you want is signature, stack them up in front of me. Don't try to open them for me. Don't try to do anything to, quote, help, because if you do, it just slows me down. I mean, just think of the process. You open the book, hand it to me, I sign. You take it back, close it, open the next one. Believe me, it's way faster for me to take the stack, flip it open, sign, move, flip, sign. You'll watch. I'm so good at this. and so if you have 25 books, I will take all 25 at once if they're signature only. Just blow right down through the stack. It doesn't take that long. It's really fast. A couple of other things. There are some of you who think that it's really helpful to pre-open the books, except you already have probably pre-opened them to the title page, and I don't sign the title page, so it really slows me down. So if you've done that, please don't. Please undo them, because I sign the half title page. You don't have to find that one. I'll find it. I found it in every. I find them like that in all my books, okay? But the half title page is the one that has only the title, doesn't have my name. In Ender Shadow, in Shadow Puppets, there are 2 of them. One that is the very first page after the flyleaf. That's the one I sign, not the one that's farther back in. And that gives room for my vain, flamboyant signature, because it's really big and extravagant and annoying. But that's the one I sign. A couple of other things. The only books that make sense to date are the new ones. Shadow Puppets, Rebecca, First Meetings, the Phobos Anthology. I'll date those automatically. You don't even have to ask, because I just date all the new ones. But if they've come out in paperback, if they're not new, why date them? You know, a 1985 edition of Ender's Game signed in 2002 doesn't mean anything. The date doesn't mean anything. So let's not do that. Dating is longer than my signature. So that's another thing. Believe me, I am saving time by talking this much. Likewise, there are some of you here who have been assigned to come by teachers who are giving you extra credit. And in Santa Clara recently, I had a teacher assign 75 students to come to the signing. That was great. I was glad to have them there. But required that they all get their books signed and dated. After 3 people, I realized what was going on, and I told them to go back to the teacher and tell her that I graduated a long time ago, and no teacher ain't giving me no assignment now. 'Cause, you can give your students assignments where they do the work, but you can't give your students assignments where I do the work, because I'm not doing it, okay? But pictures. There are a lot of you who want, well, not a lot, but there are always some people in line who want pictures. You can take pictures if you're in them, so arrange with somebody near you in line to take the picture for you. And what you should do is, while I'm signing a book, just move around behind me as soon as I'm done signing, lean down in so our faces are together, because, you know, who needs the whole body? Not mine. And then we can take the shot, and it won't slow down the line, so the people behind you won't start going, while we wait for the picture to be taken. So if we all cooperate, we can make this go so smoothly and quickly that you will feel like it took you won't. The guys at the end of the line are going to feel like it took forever no matter what we do. But still, be patient. It'll all work out. And I will stay till everybody's book is signed. Okay? Now, is there anything from the people who are actually in charge of this? Where are we actually going? Okay, he's going to take me out the back, so you guys can just take off.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.